Good morning, this is Brian Trumworth, Week in Review for Saturday, January 29th. Funny how every now and then geopolitics injects itself into the equation when attempting to determine the direction of the financial markets, isn't it? As stocks swooned Friday afternoon over the scenes from Egypt, it couldn't help but smile a little, as unseemly as that might sound. It's just that it always cracks me up when one analyst after another parades before the cameras during normal times and never mentions the ability of geopolitics to change sentiment in a flash. No, I didn't foresee the tumult thus far in Tunisia and Egypt, but I've certainly warned you on others in the region, particularly Lebanon, where we've now officially had a change in government that is most worrisome. One thing about Egypt that is ironic is that it was just last Sunday that the government announced it had conclusive proof that an Al-Qaeda-linked Palestinian militant group orchestrated the New Year's Day bombing outside the Coptic Christian church that killed 25 and which helped fuel tensions between Muslims and Copts. But then 2 days later, events of a different kind began to explode in Egypt as the largely disaffected youth picked up the torch from their equally disaffected brethren in Tunisia and demanded that another long-running show take its act to another venue, like perhaps exile in Saudi Arabia. It was time, say Egyptians, for 82-year-old President Hosni Mubarak to give it up, a la Tunisia's Ben Ali. Late Friday, Mubarak addressed his seething nation, saying he would shuffle some deck chairs, but that he himself was not leaving. As I go to post, Mubarak seems intent on not even making a concession not to run in September's presidential election, which is a minimal requirement if he isn't to be hung by the mob or gunned down by his own guards, which was the fate of his predecessor Anwar Sadat, assassinated by men in army uniforms later linked to the Muslim Brotherhood, which Mubarak has spent his 30 years muzzling. And so, with this little history lesson, you're reminded of the Brotherhood and other Muslim extremists that lie below the surface across most of the Arab world and the Middle East. It's why the developments in Tunisia and Egypt are so scary. For all their deep faults, the two countries have been bulwarks against Islamists, and now there isn't anyone who can tell you definitively whether the events across North Africa will augur in a new era of terror and suppression of a different kind, with the main exports being car bombs and suicide attacks on theaters and restaurants in Europe and the United States. We just don't know what the endgame is for Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Algeria, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. Could it be the spread of an explosion of true democratic reform? If you want to live in happy land the rest of your life, I guess you can dream about such a denouement. But here's what is getting lost in the early analysis of what could easily just be the top of the first inning. Runners on first and second, no outs, but with the pitcher having opened up by hitting his first two batters and the count now at 3-0 and a third batsman, the manager and pitching coach shuffling uneasily as the bullpen begins to stir. Even if there are some positive outcomes in the likes of Tunisia and Egypt, the transitions are going to be long and drawn out, with internal security focused on maintaining order and securing a new government. And that means one thing. The extremists will have safe haven at a minimum, knowing that the security forces are focused elsewhere. It'll be like when Egypt opens up the gate to Gaza and the refugees come flooding out for a breath of fresh air, while missiles slip in. Instead of having to dodge drones in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Somalia, and Yemen, Al-Qaeda-like groups will proliferate throughout the entire region. The West will be helpless, not having a strong relationship with the new leaders, whoever they might be. It will be a multi-year window where the evildoers can plot and export terror with little concern that they will be bothered inside their new homes. So we don't know how things are going to shake out. Maybe the pitcher gets out of the first inning jam only to get knocked out in the second. We do know the fuse has been lit and the opposition smells blood. As to country specifics, if you can tell me what Tunisia is going to look like in just a month, let alone a year, you're a better man than me. Ditto Egypt. But as I mentioned last time, one country that didn't get too much press this week that I'm focused on is Jordan. It was May 2008 when I spent a week touring there, and I told you of how I was spooked by some of the Palestinian encampments and how it wasn't exactly the most friendly place yours truly has ever been in. The Palestinians have always been a huge potential flashpoint for King Abdullah II, and you must be scared to death right now as protests started up on Friday. Syria is worth watching if for no other reason than President Bashar Assad has always walked a tightrope, just as his father before him, though any change here could be a positive change of pace. And, of course, I worry about Lebanon, which now is a prime minister-designate, Najib Mikati, a billionaire with close ties to Syria and the choice of Hezbollah to replace Saad Hariri. Mikati wasn't Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah's first choice, but he will do, as Hezbollah has orchestrated a coup in first toppling the Hariri government and then replacing him with a leader of their liking. So while Mikati is saying all the right things initially and claiming to be his own man and a friend to the West, including Washington, he is immediately faced with a huge challenge. Does he have Lebanon cut ties with the UN-backed Special Tribunal for Lebanon, STL, that has apparently implicated Hezbollah, Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei, and possibly Syria, or does he courageously continue to fund it in the face of immense pressure from Hezbollah? Mikati said he will proceed with the STL. I say he is met by some goons one night who threaten to disembowel him on the spot unless he swears off it. As for the former leader, now technically caretaker Prime Minister Saad Hariri, for now he is saying he will lead the opposition and that he wants no part of a Hezbollah-led government. My friend Michael Young in Beirut says Hariri must remain in the new power-sharing apparatus if he is to stay viable. One thing is for certain, Hezbollah isn't about to be disarmed and they are calling the shots. The flip side, however, is they now own it. They can be held responsible. But you want a nightmare scenario, as if all the preceding isn't bad enough. Islamists eventually take over Egypt, break the peace treaty with Israel, precipitate a war, and Hezbollah then launches an attack across the other border in conjunction with Hamas. You can be sure Israel's leaders are gaming this out as I write. At least they better be. Here's a somewhat different opinion from the editorial, from The Economist, an editorial. Quote, many Islamists think God and the Quran should take precedence over parliaments, parties, pluralism, and popular debate. At the extreme end of the Islamist spectrum are hard men whose rule would be a lot harsher than that of Mr. Ben Ali and his ilk. But in few Arab countries is an extreme version of Islam either preponderant or popular. The Muslim Brotherhood, the true opposition in Egypt, embraces a range of attitudes. The more tolerant and sensible in its number are probably the most popular. Seeing that undemocratic secular regimes have failed to give them satisfaction, Arabs should be allowed to vote for Islamists if that is their wish. It is a risk for themselves and for the rest of the world. However, as the past few weeks have shown, winking at secular despots as they tighten the screws on their disgruntled people may in the long run be riskier. Tunisia's upheaval has only just begun. No one knows where it will lead. It has already opened an Arab Pandora's box. Frightening things may leap out, but it nonetheless deserves an enthusiastic welcome. That was The Economist. Turning to the United States and President Obama's State of the Union address, I said weeks ago that once he had made the move to the center on the tax cut extension and stimulus measures, I assumed he would use this annual platform before Congress and the American people to spell out the importance of reducing the deficit. Instead, forget the polls and the immediate aftermath that show the president received high marks. I bet by Monday, if you poll them all again, the results would be very different. The speech was an unmitigated disaster because he did not in any serious way address the paramount issue of our times domestically. And whereas last week I said the latest round of polls that gave him a bounce for his moves in December gave him a big leg up for 2012, Obama's demonstrated failure of leadership on Tuesday meant one thing for Republicans. Game on. Plus, as pointed out earlier, there is little going on overseas now that will find its way into 2012 campaign ads, I imagine. Charles Krauthammer, Washington Post. The November election sent a clear message to Washington. Less government, less debt, less spending. President Obama certainly heard it, but judging from his State of the Union address, he doesn't believe a word of it. The people say they want cuts? Sure they do, in the abstract, but any party that actually dares carry them out will be punished severely. On that, Obama stakes his re-election. No other conclusion can be drawn from a speech that didn't even address the debt issue until 35 minutes in. And then what did he offer? A freeze on domestic discretionary spending that he himself admitted would affect a mere one-eighth of the budget. Krauthammer continues, he's been chastened enough by the election of 2010 to make gestures toward the center. But the State of the Union address had revealed a man ideologically unbowed and undeterred. He served up an insignificant spending cut, yet another, if more modest, stimulus, and a promise to fight any Republican attempt to significantly shrink the size of government. Indeed, he went beyond this. He tried to cast this more of the same into a call to national greatness, citing two Michigan brothers who produce solar shingles as a stirring example of rising to the Sputnik moment. "We do big things," Obama declared at the end of an address that was, on the contrary, the finest example of small-ball Clintonian minimalism since the days of school uniforms and midnight basketball. From the moon landing to solar shingles, is there a better example of American decline? That was Charles Krauthammer of the Washington Post. On Wall Street, the major averages fell, with the Dow Jones losing 0.4% to 11,823, the S&P 500 0.5%, and NASDAQ losing a fraction 0.1% to 2686. Some, such as Caterpillar, were bullish in their earnings releases, with CAT's CFO saying, "We're very optimistic about what's going on in the developing parts of the world." But some of the others, such as McDonald's and Johnson & Johnson, were unexciting, while Ford's fourth quarter report on Friday shocked the street. Ford was projected to come in with earnings of 48 cents and instead did 30. In response, the stock dropped 13%, $2.50. Ford blamed a loss at its European Union and new model cost, but CEO Alan Mulally conceded he needed to do a better job of communicating with analysts. Meanwhile, the preliminary reading on fourth quarter GDP came in at 3.2%, worse than the expected 3.5, but not awful. It just needs to get much better if we are to put a real dent in the unemployment rate. That's all for now. I have far more details in my Week in Review column at stocksandnews.com. So go to that. Have a great week, and I'll be back with you next Saturday. Take care.